Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence, this Tuesday, July 28, 2026, for our Commodities and Energy Edition.
Today, we are examining the breakdown of predictable energy pricing models as geopolitical friction moves from the periphery to the core. The era of stable maritime transit is being replaced by a landscape where localized conflict dictates global inflation.
So we're moving from market volatility to systemic supply shocks.
Precisely.
We begin by analyzing the intensifying energy volatility driven by the escalating crisis in the Strait of Hormuz. July 15th, the AMAC buy tender premium for middle distillates jumped from a stable $2 or $3 in June to the high teens and even low 20s. We are looking at a complete breakdown in the predictability of energy flows. Today, we're analyzing the intensifying energy volatility driven by the Strait of Hormuz crisis and the shifting geography of global crude.
It's a massive structural realignment. We aren't just seeing price swings, we're seeing a fundamental transition from a normalization mindset back to a high-risk disruption focus.
It's hard not to feel like we're watching a slow-motion train wreck where the tracks are being removed right in front of the locomotive.
If you look at the mechanics, the primary driver isn't even a lack of physical production capacity in Iran right now. According to Argus Media, the immediate impact of Iranian production halts is secondary to the maritime blockade itself. The inability to transit the Strait of Hormuz simply renders any existing or restored Iranian production irrelevant to global supply.
So the oil is there, it's just trapped behind a wall of drones and speedboats.
And it's not just Iran. We are seeing a massive multi-layered squeeze. On Bloomberg Surveillance, analysts highlighted how the Houthi maritime ban on Saudi-linked vessels has triggered a massive structural shift in oil logistics. This is forcing roughly 3 million barrels per day of Saudi crude to reroute from the Red Sea around the Cape of Good Hope. That detour adds approximately 30 days of travel time and an estimated $2.40 per barrel in direct costs from fuel, Suez fees, and ship hire.
So we're essentially paying a geopolitical detour tax on every barrel that avoids the Red Sea.
The implication runs deeper, that cost is compounding. We're seeing a double whammy in the middle distillate markets. Russia's July export ban is forcing European refineries to maximize gas oil output, which is driving up European cracks and pulling arbitrage interest away from Asia. At the same time, increased maritime security risks in both the Strait of Hormuz and the Bab al-Mandab are driving up shipping costs and reducing daily vessel transits.
It sounds like the entire global supply chain is just one bad afternoon away from a total seizure.
The data supports that fear. Look at the divergence in cargo pricing. Oil Markets reports that supply chain volatility is driving a divergence in cargo pricing based entirely on geography. Gas oil cargoes loaded outside the Strait of Hormuz are commanding double-digit premiums, while those from inside the strait are trading at significant double-digit discounts. Even the EFS spread, the difference between Brent and the Mediterranean, widened from the negative 70s to below negative 100 by mid-July, signaling massive arbitrage opportunities for those who can brave the risk, despite the rising shipping costs.
And then there's the chemical side. I was reading about the methanol markets, and it sounds like the shockwaves are hitting far more than just the gas pump.
They are. Cassidy Staggers and Dave McCaskill of Argus discussed a massive 4.5 million ton supply loss following the reported closure of the strait. While the U.S. maintains the strait is technically open, the market is pricing in the logistical risk of ship attacks. This creates a massive vulnerability for India. Argus Media notes that India faces a disproportionate price shock compared to Southeast Asia because of its high structural reliance on the now disrupted Iranian supply stream.
So even if the tankers can move, the insurance and the fear make the trade unviable.
Right, and there's a looming supply gap risk for the end of the year. McCaskill anticipates that Q4 2026 is the major risk period. The real crisis for the methanol industry will manifest when the physical absence of Middle East exports finally hits the ports in Asia because the scheduled shipments simply fail to arrive.
It feels like the Trump administration is caught in a corner here. They want to exert pressure on Iran, but the leverage seems to be swinging back toward Tehran.
That's the textbook escalation trap. The U.S. has a massive interest in maintaining the flow of trade. But as Bloomberg Surveillance noted, U.S. strategic flexibility is being constrained by a munitions trap, where depleted air defense stockpiles, specifically Patriot interceptors, may actually force a diplomatic de-escalation regardless of the administration's preferred policy.
Which is a terrifying thought for the markets. If the policy is driven by what's left in the missile silos rather than diplomatic strategy, we have no way to model the volatility.
and the economic fallout is already visible in the energy-to-politics pipeline. Monica Guerra noted on Bloomberg Surveillance that energy price volatility acts as a political multiplier. While high oil prices benefit firms like ExxonMobil and Chevron, the affordability issues they drive can expand average seat losses for an incumbent party from 6 seats to as many as 32.
The high price of a barrel of Brent, which we've seen surge above $90, is essentially a direct threat to the Republican Party's momentum.
It's a strategic trap. The volatility is creating a massive divergence between corporate energy profitability and voter sentiment.
We're watching a global energy map being redrawn in real time, where the new borders are defined by where a tanker is actually willing to sail.
And we can't forget the secondary risks. John Ollett noted that LPG freight rates have already surpassed the $100 per ton threshold due to the U.S.-Iran war. If the disruptions in the Panama Canal follow the 2023 precedent, we could see an additional $100 per ton added to those costs. We are seeing a convergence of disruptions, Hormuz, the Red Sea, and the Panama Canal, all creating a highly inflationary effect on global energy and plastics.
It's a total systemic squeeze.
It is.
The market has moved from a period of expected normalization to a period of pure disruption risk.
Indian importers need to start looking at alternative sourcing before the Q4 shipment gap hits.
Keep an eye on the Chinese export policy for clean petroleum products. If Beijing decides to prioritize domestic inventories to protect against Middle Eastern shortages, the global supply pool will shrink even further.
But if we can move past the tanker lanes, we have to deal with a much more domestic struggle over the massive amount of electricity needed to keep the lights on for the next generation of computing. I'm starting to think the cloud is actually just a very expensive, very thirsty physical construction site that we've all been pretending is invisible.
That's a bit dramatic, Maya, even for you. It's not invisible, it's just being re-architected into the most significant commodity-driven infrastructure build-out of our generation.
Fine, let's call it what it is then, the AI power crunch. We're essentially watching the tech sector undergo a massive, identity-shattering metamorphosis from software wizards into heavy-duty utilities.
It's more than just an identity crisis, it's a fundamental shift in the balance sheet. We're seeing large-cap tech companies move from being high free cash flow generators to becoming high-debt entities that look more like regulated utilities than software firms.
Which sounds lovely for the shareholders, I'm sure, as long as the lights stay on. But are we actually seeing a real surge in demand, or is this just the usual hype cycle demanding more copper and transformers?
The demand is quantifiable and massive. We are looking at a projection where data center loads jump from roughly 4 to 5 gigawatts up to as much as 160 gigawatts. And the capital is already moving. Bloomberg Surveillance reported that there is a hidden layer of massive capex in the AI sector, specifically $700 billion in data center lease commitments that haven't even begun construction yet, meaning they are completely invisible in traditional financial reporting and leverage metrics.
So there is a massive $700 billion ghost fleet of data centers waiting in the wings, and we can't even see them on the balance sheets. That is exactly the kind of lack of transparency that makes me want to check my basement for a transformer.
Well, it's not just about the size of the fleet, but the pressure it puts on the existing pipes. The growth in the commercial and industrial sector, particularly in constrained regions like PJM, is threatening to reverse the traditional benefits of load growth. Usually, more users mean lower unit prices because you spread fixed grid costs across a larger base. But if the growth outpaces the build-out, you get expensive, urgent infrastructure requirements before cost allocation mechanisms can even adjust.
So instead of a smoother ride, we get grid congestion. And I assume that's just a polite way of saying massive price spikes whenever someone runs a large training model.
It's even more concentrated than that. Chartbook flagged that grid congestion isn't just a constant systemic drain, it's a highly concentrated volatility risk. In 2024, for instance, $10 billion of the $12 billion in total wholesale power costs stemmed from just 5% of operating hours during peak stress events.
We're paying a massive premium for a tiny window of chaos.
It's a telling detail. And the bottleneck isn't just about the electricity itself, but the physical ability to move it. Expanding the physical grid to meet this modern demand could arguably become the most expensive infrastructure project in human history, because we're hitting a simultaneous surge in renewables, EVs, and a massive backlog in the transformer and copper supply chains.
It's a perfect storm of everything is stuck. And I suppose the natural gas industry is just sitting there waiting to be the hero of the story.
If they can actually supply it. But there's a looming supply-side vulnerability. Dumergue highlighted Matthew Smith's systemic modeling of the American natural gas system, which predicts a structural natural gas shortage beginning in 2028, potentially leading to the total exhaustion of working storage capacity by 2030. The entire AI growth trajectory relies on a supply chain that is predicted to face a high-price crisis driven by demand outstripping production.
We're building a trillion-dollar digital brain that might starve to death by 2030 because we ran out of gas.
It's why the industry is looking for alternatives. We're seeing a shift toward speed to power, where the value is moving away from the lowest cost generation to the fastest deployable capacity. Even the concept of location is changing. Redefining Energy noted that Elon Musk predicts that within 36 months, space could become the most economically compelling location for AI training, because you can scale energy-intensive chips without Earth's electrical constraints, utilizing solar panels that are 5 times more effective than those on the ground.
Oh, great. We're moving the energy crisis to orbit. Because what the space industry really needs is more satellites beaming power down to Earth.
It's actually becoming a scalable operating expense. Starcatcher's orbital energy grid technology aims to transform satellite power from a heavy CapEx into an OpEx by beaming energy via visible and near-infrared light. It allows smaller, cheaper satellites to access the power capacity of much larger vessels.
I'm still stuck on the idea that we're basically just building a giant, expensive radiator for the planet. If the big players are spending this much, they're going to want their money back, which usually means someone else is footing the bill via higher tariffs.
That's the tension. We're seeing a supply-side squeeze in the energy transition, where tariffs on Chinese lithium-ion cells have ended the era of declining storage costs, pushing 4-hour standalone systems back up to the $210 to $292 per megawatt-hour range. This makes managing the grid much harder.
The tech giants are turning into utilities, the utilities are running out of gas, and the grid is becoming a volatility engine.
But for investors, there is a silver lining. Bloomberg Surveillance noted that the utilities sector offers a strategic hedge against broader economic and political volatility. As Guerra suggests, despite the political unpopularity of rising energy costs, the sheer structural necessity of this data center expansion provides a fundamental growth driver that remains decoupled from how the electorate feels.
Just as long as the regulators don't decide that utility-style profits are too much to ask for.
That's the wild card. We are looking at a massive $1 trillion projected CapEx spent by the top 5 hyperscalers by 2027. That level of dominance could trigger a regulatory backlash, where governments might impose profit caps on the infrastructure models, much like they do in regulated energy markets.
Grid operators need to pivot from worst-case scenario engineering to real-time system optimization to avoid the bankruptcy of the entire network. Watch for the next major seasonal peak in PJM or ERCOT. If we see wholesale prices decoupling from long-term trends during those short windows, the volatility risk thesis is officially proven. But if the infrastructure is this expensive to build, it makes you wonder how much more pressure the central banks can take before they're forced to step in and manage the fallout of all this massive, interest rate insensitive spending. We are currently caught between two massive grinding gears, a central bank trying to anchor inflation and a Treasury department that seems to have forgotten how to stop spending. It feels like the era of monetary policy being the primary driver of the economy is being eclipsed by something much more volatile. Alex, if you had to bet, are we looking at a return to disciplined interest rate control, or is the era of fiscal dominance officially here?
If you're betting on the Fed having the final say, you might be holding a very expensive bag. We are seeing a structural shift where massive government debt and primary deficits are starting to dictate the trajectory of the bond market, rather than the other way around. On Bloomberg Surveillance, analysts pointed out that the Fed under Kevin Warsh may actually be using volatility in short-term rates as a strategic shock absorber. The goal there isn't just inflation control, it's to stabilize the long end of the yield curve to protect much more sensitive costs like corporate and mortgage borrowing.
The Fed isn't necessarily fighting inflation so much as it's performing a delicate surgical procedure to keep the government's debt from causing a cardiac event.
And the scale of that debt is the problem. We're seeing U.S. real yields hit 2.34%, the highest since 2023, and the market is pricing that move less because of inflation expectations and more because of growing anxiety over the debt trajectory. It creates this fiscal dominance trap. As David Beckworth has argued, true economic independence requires the U.S. to meet its obligations without the Fed essentially acting as a printing press to fund the Treasury. If the Fed is forced to intervene in treasury markets just to prevent insolvency, the line between providing market liquidity and managing a sovereign debt crisis becomes dangerously blurred.
And that blurred line is a nightmare for anyone trying to price energy or commodities, because suddenly the price of oil isn't just about geopolitics, it's about whether the Fed is forced to print money to cover a deficit.
It's even more complicated because we have a supply-side shock hitting us from the top down. Jim Caron has noted that rising energy prices are creating a supply-side shock that traditional demand-side tools, like hiking rates, can't easily fix. It puts the Fed in a strategic trap. If they hike rates to combat energy-driven inflation, they risk a secondary demand shock that crushes the rest of the economy.
It's like trying to put out a kitchen fire by flooding the entire house.
And the house is already under immense structural pressure. Julia Coronado highlighted a Dutch disease risk emerging in the U.S. economy. We have these massive, interest rate insensitive capital expenditures flowing into AI hyperscaling. This creates a situation where the Fed might be forced to implement aggressive policy tightening to offset the inflationary pressures of the AI boom, but that tightening disproportionately damages sectors like housing that can't absorb the cost of capital.
So the AI boom effectively becomes a tax on the rest of the economy via the Fed.
The data tells a story. We can't ignore the liquidity mismatch. Bloomberg Surveillance flagged a significant structural risk for the second half of 2026. The bond market is pricing in Fed rate hikes that are pulling liquidity out of the system, even as the overvalued equity market is facing massive liquidity needs to fund that very same AI expansion. If you add the 2028 maturity wall for software debt into the mix, we are looking at a massive volume of leverage-laden debt that must be refinanced under much harsher conditions in the next 18 months.
It sounds like we're moving toward a day of reckoning where the sheer weight of all this accumulated leverage meets the reality of higher rates.
That's exactly the fear. Edward Chancellor and Paul Chapman have discussed this looming reckoning, noting that central bank policies since the global financial crisis have focused on what is seen, like employment recovery, while ignoring the unseen long-term damage of misallocated capital and ballooning debt. The problem is that interest rates cannot be normalized without risking a collapse of the financial system, because rising rates simultaneously crash inflated asset prices and make it impossible for heavily leveraged companies to roll over their debt.
It's the classic trap. We've spent a decade building an ecosystem that can only survive on cheap money, and now the bill is coming due.
And the creditors are changing too. Macro Voices pointed out a fundamental shift. Major global creditors like Japan, Germany, and Korea are moving from being surplus-driven lenders to active borrowers to fund defense stimulus. This shift is likely to force Western central banks into explicit or implicit yield curve control, just to manage the resulting volatility in the bond markets.
So between the energy shocks, the AI-driven Dutch disease, and the debt-fueled supply-side pressures, the era of predictable monetary policy is essentially dead.
We are entering an era where the Treasury's balance sheet is the most important indicator for the Fed's next move.
Long-duration bond investors need to reevaluate their hedging strategies as the Treasury's deficit needs begin to override inflation targets. Watch for a spike in Treasury volatility that breaks the correlation between real yields and inflation expectations. But this massive shift in how nations fund themselves is only part of the story. We also need to look at how the very concept of global trade is being rewritten by a new wave of economic nationalism. Alex, is the era of global trade actually dead, or are we just watching the world trade inefficiency for a much more expensive subscription to security?
It's not quite a death, Maya, but we are seeing a fundamental structural pivot. We're moving away from neoliberal globalization, where everything was optimized for the lowest cost, and into what Branko Milinovic calls national market liberalism.
National market liberalisms. That sounds like a fancy way of saying we're all putting up fences and hoping the neighbors don't notice.
It's more about a zero-sum approach to trade. As Odlotz noted, Western governments are essentially pivoting away from internal redistribution, like taxing the wealthy or investing in public education, to instead target China's external advantages through tariffs. It's a strategic choice to fight an external competitor rather than fixing domestic inequality.
Instead of fixing the leaky roof in our own house, we're just buying a bigger, more expensive lock for the front door and calling it a victory.
We can trace that further for the commodities sector. That lock is incredibly expensive. CTVC by Sightline Climate highlighted how the 50% tariff on Canadian cement under the Trump administration is directly inflating the capital expenditures needed for U.S. transmission projects. You want a green energy transition, but the raw materials to build the grid are now caught in a trade war.
And I assume China isn't just sitting there playing defense.
Not at all. They are using what Doomer describes as a toggle strategy. They scale back domestic subsidies just enough to pivot their industrial capacity toward aggressive global exports. They aren't just protecting their market, they are flooding ours.
It's like a competitor in a local bake sale suddenly deciding to mass-produce cookies in a factory overseas and then undercutting everyone at the booth.
Two things stand out, but with much higher stakes. This isn't just about consumer goods, it's about the sovereignty trap. The erosion of manufacturing capacity means a nation might lose the ability to produce the industrial base required for military hardware, like tanks or helicopters. We see it in the disparity between Ukraine's ability to produce 10,000 drones daily versus the massive manufacturing gaps in U.S. shipbuilding.
The supply chain isn't just a logistics problem anymore, it's a weapons system.
It is.
China has moved from market dominance to weaponization, having introduced 24 different restrictions on metals and technology through late 2025. They've used a vertical reintegration strategy, accepting losses in upstream mining to capture the high-value downstream manufacturing in EVs and batteries.
Which explains why gold is suddenly looking like the only thing that doesn't care about a trade dispute.
That's the hedge.
Macro Voices pointed out that the move toward yuan and gold-settled systems is real, evidenced by the $2 trillion CIPS volume record back in May.
Investors in industrial metals need to rethink their long-term exposure to Chinese-dominated downstream nodes. Keep an eye on whether Brazil or Malaysia start mirroring U.S.-style import limits on Chinese components. But if the metals trade is becoming a battlefield, I wonder how much the changing weather patterns are going to disrupt the next layer of the stack, the global flow of grain and fertilizer. We all thought the post-pandemic commodity chaos was settling into a predictable rhythm, but instead, we're watching the global supply chain enter a sort of high-stakes game of musical chairs.
It's less a game and more a series of cascading cost shocks, particularly in the agricultural sector, where El Niño is rewriting the map for the 2026-27 season. S&P Global analysts note that drier, erratic weather is threatening rain-fed production across India and Myanmar, driving rice prices up by 20-30% in several Asian origins.
Everyone is just scrambling for whatever grain isn't currently drying up in the sun.
But the demand is decoupling. While the Philippines is aggressively building reserves, larger players like China are playing a wait-and-see game. It's not just volume, either. Delayed monsoons in India could increase moisture content in paddy, which hikes milling costs and erodes India's price advantage.
And I suppose the fertilizer market is enjoying just as much stability.
Not at all. Argus Media reports a feedback loop where Middle East tensions inflate sulfur and freight costs, driving up production expenses for phosphoric acid. This is forcing Mosaic to reduce production at its Brazilian facilities through the second half of 2026. Brazilian farmers are already pivoting to cheaper, low-concentration alternatives like Super Simples to dodge high MAP prices, which are currently sitting around $895 per ton.
It sounds like a delightful way to ensure the upcoming October soybean planting is a total disaster.
It's a structural risk. We're seeing estimates that 20%-30% of the expected demand for the next Brazilian cycle remains untraded because high fertilizer costs and limited credit access are stalling procurement.
Investors in Brazilian agribusiness need to rethink their exposure to the October planting window. Watch for the next Indian phosphate tender. If it breaks the $950 range, the substitution trend in Brazil will likely collapse. As we wrap up this edition, the through line is clear. We are witnessing the physicalization of risk. Whether it's the rerouting of 3 million barrels of Saudi crude to avoid maritime threats, or the massive, unrecorded capital commitments building the infrastructure for AI, the era of abstract, frictionless trade has been replaced by a heavy, resource-intensive reality. Energy and commodities are no longer just inputs. They are the primary friction points in a world redesigning its entire industrial map.
That's exactly right, Maya. The most critical shift isn't just about higher prices. It's about the fundamental change in how the world's largest utilities and hyperscalers must calculate their long-term viability. For the massive energy providers and grid operators in the US and Europe, the calculus has moved from managing seasonal demand to managing structural scarcity. They are no longer just providing power. They are attempting to bridge a massive gap between the skyrocketing electricity needs of a trillion-dollar data center expansion and a natural gas supply chain that is staring down potential shortages by 2028. The margin for error in infrastructure investment has effectively vanished.
It all points to a world where the physical constraints of the Earth, The availability of gas, the stability of shipping lanes, and the capacity of the grid are now the ultimate arbiters of economic policy.
The pattern is clear to see if this trend of physical scarcity is accelerating. Keep a close eye on the upcoming methanol supply reports from the Middle East. Any confirmation of a sustained deficit in that market would signal that the localized disruptions we're seeing today are hardening into a permanent, structural feature of the global commodity landscape.
Thanks for joining us this Tuesday. We'll see you next week.